When Christian Hagaseth left his house on a February morning in 2013, he was carrying $40,000 in cash to meet with an architect who had designed the world's first weedery, a $30 million tourist destination for cannabis enthusiasts. The architect's reluctance to accept drug money highlighted just one of countless challenges facing entrepreneurs in America's fastest-growing industry. Hagaseth's journey from real estate developer to cannabis pioneer mirrors the dramatic transformation of marijuana in American society, from demonized substance to legitimate business opportunity. His company, Green Man Cannabis, grew from $300,000 in first-year revenue to projections of $97 million for their cannabis ranch project. With medical marijuana now legal in over half of U.S. states and recreational use expanding rapidly, we're witnessing a profound shift comparable to the end of prohibition, one that's creating fortunes for early investors while challenging decades of cultural stigma. As cannabis moves from the shadows into corporate boardrooms, the race is on to create the next lifestyle brand as embraced as Starbucks or Apple. It all began in 2009 when Hagaseth met Jake, a stocky Latino businessman, during a round of golf. When Jake revealed he operated in the legal medical marijuana business, Hagaseth's entrepreneurial instincts immediately activated. Colorado had approved medical marijuana back in 2000, but Hagaseth knew little about the industry beyond that basic fact. The difference between the ditchweed of his youth and Jake's vibrant, colorful buds was revelatory, like discovering fine wine after drinking cheap supermarket Cabernet. As they smoked overlooking Denver from the 17th hole, Hagaseth's mind raced with business possibilities. Though Jake couldn't articulate his exact margins or costs, Hagaseth saw enormous potential. He agreed to consult with Jake's firm, already envisioning a marijuana company the way Michelangelo saw David in marble, complete in his mind before the first chisel strike. Within days, Hagaseth visited an elderly doctor to obtain his red card, Colorado's official medical marijuana documentation. After describing a legitimate snowboarding injury that compressed a thoracic vertebra, causing ongoing pain, the doctor helped him complete the paperwork. When asked why he wrote marijuana recommendations, the doctor simply replied, "I always thought marijuana was harmless. I'm glad I'm able to finally do this for people." Hagaseth's first dispensary visit was mind-blowing. The powerful scent of fresh marijuana hit him immediately upon entering. The staff, bud tenders, presented about 10 tall glass jars filled with colorful buds and asked what kind of marijuana he preferred. This question stunned him, as his only previous experience was whatever his buddy's friend happened to have. In Jake's dispensary, he discovered there were many different strains, each with unique names and characteristics, a far cry from his 1980s experience of hunting down whatever single option was available. The numbers in Jake's business were staggering. It cost vendors $500 to $800 to grow a pound of legal marijuana, which could then be sold for $6,400 retail in quarter-ounce increments or $4,000 wholesale, an 800 to 1300% profit margin. These extraordinary figures kept the marijuana business in Hagaseth's thoughts long after his consulting work with Jake ended. Before considering marijuana, Hagaseth had been the founder and CEO of a national real estate company during the 2002-2008 housing boom. At 38, he was a self-made millionaire who had developed a novel way of financing real estate pools. His company was approaching a public offering with a net asset value of $1 billion when the housing market collapsed. Despite his personal assets remaining safe, dismantling his company over 15 months forced him to confront uncomfortable truths about himself. He realized he had never learned the meaning of enough, always wanting more money without finding satisfaction. This epiphany led him to understand that money was meaningless compared to family, integrity, passion, and purpose. Despite his wife's fears about financial stability, legal marijuana increasingly looked like a smart opportunity that aligned with his new values. Hagaseth immersed himself in the industry, visiting dispensaries across Denver, compiling lists of establishments to check out, buying books on marijuana history and cultivation, and following media coverage. he learned about the three basic cannabis species: cannabis sativa, impacting the mind with psychedelic highs; cannabis indica, affecting the body, good for physical pain; and cannabis ruderalis, low in THC, but useful for hemp production. Dispensaries offer dozens of exotic-sounding strains like OG Kush, Bubba Kush, Cheesequake, and Alaskan Thunderfuck. He discovered cannabis has ancient roots, used by holy people for at least 12,000 years, with archaeological evidence dating back 8,000 years across China, Romania, India, Egypt, and Europe. Even historical figures like Shakespeare may have enjoyed cannabis, while Washington, Jefferson, and Adams grew hemp for industrial purposes. The marijuana shopping experience resembled wine tasting or craft beer sampling, with bud tenders describing complex flavor profiles and effects. Unlike wine's relatively consistent alcohol content, marijuana's potency varied dramatically, from the 3% THC that baked Woodstock in 1969 to modern strains exceeding 23% THC. This sevenfold increase resulted from breeders obsessively pushing limits, treating cannabis cultivation as their artistic medium. Marijuana prohibition in America has roots in racism and greed. In the 19th century, cannabis was openly grown and used medicinally as cannabis indica. By 1913, southwestern states began passing laws against marijuana, a foreign-sounding term deliberately used to distance it from familiar hemp or cannabis. Mexican laborers smoking weed were portrayed as dangerous in racist newspaper campaigns. In 1930, Harry J. Anslinger became America's first drug czar, launching a media campaign linking marijuana to minorities and violence against white women. By 1937, the Marijuana Tax Act effectively banned cannabis despite minimal scientific evidence supporting claims of its dangers. The propaganda film Reefer Madness further demonized marijuana. Ironically, during World War II, the government produced Hemp for Victory, encouraging farmers to grow hemp for the war effort, later denying the film existed. In 1972, a commission found no justification for harsh marijuana laws, noting it wasn't addictive, wasn't a gateway drug, and didn't cause violence, findings President Nixon ignored when creating the DEA. As Hegesith's marijuana education continued, he saw a promising industry desperately needing optimization. Most dispensary owners were marijuana enthusiasts first and business people second, lacking long-term vision for marijuana as America's newest consumer product. They weren't considering how packaging, marketing, public perception, and branding would impact success. Despite his wife's increasing concerns about potential arrest or bankruptcy, his mother remained open-minded, and his neighbor, Mr. Pink, became enthusiastic about the venture. After discussing the business model and numbers, Mr. Pink invested $125,000, making them official drug dealers, but unlike any other ganjapreneurs in the market. Hegesith needed expertise desperately. Being clueless about plants, he needed to hire a master grower who could help him buy equipment and guide him through his first harvest. After several disappointing meetings, he finally met Adam, a calm, deliberate 31-year-old who had been growing marijuana for 15 years, having learned from his hippie parents in California. Growing marijuana indoors proved incredibly resource-intensive. They needed powerful lamps that generated heat, which required air conditioners to control temperature and humidity, creating a cascade of power consumption. Unlike his previous business experiences where he could cram and rush things, plants stubbornly stuck to their own schedule, a humbling lesson for Hegesith. Despite these challenges, he felt wonderfully aligned with nature for the first time in his professional life. In late fall 2009, Hegesith proudly carried his first harvest, about 3 pounds of 13 different strains, in a duffel bag to dispensaries on Denver's Green Mile. Despite his excitement, buyers gave lukewarm feedback. The buds weren't dried or trimmed properly. Though he sold everything, it wasn't nearly enough to cover operating costs or repay Mr. Pink's investment. Their operation was fundamentally flawed from the start. They'd created several inefficient small grows instead of one properly designed large one, using consumer-grade equipment and extension cords rather than professional electrical systems. Then disaster struck when a roofer accidentally set fire to their building's insulation and smoke damage destroyed their second harvest. The fundamental problem became clear when Hageseth found Adam building light hangers from PVC pipe because he feared buying proper equipment would alert authorities. Despite marijuana being legal now, Adam was still operating with the paranoid mindset of an illegal basement grower. Their third harvest yielded only 4 pounds, not enough to pay rent. They were officially out of cash. Failure doesn't mean your business is doomed. It simply means your current approach didn't work this time. Failures are instructive, forcing growth and providing the critical knowledge that can't be taught in business schools. Despite his initial marijuana venture imploding in 2010, Hageseth remained determined to try again, recognizing the unique opportunity the cannabis industry presented while traditional markets were collapsing. With $495,000 from Los Angeles investors, he fired Adam and brought in Brandon and Kim, two respected growers with proven track records. He implemented a two-pronged approach, renovating their main facility for 92 lights while establishing a temporary 25-light grow to generate immediate revenue. Brandon and Kim worked wonders, sourcing fantastic strains like Skunkberry and Jack Harer, with each light yielding about 1.3 pounds every other month, substantially above industry standard. This generated about $40,000 monthly in revenue. With more lights installed, they soon harvested 50 pounds worth $125,000 wholesale. Though they still faced substantial expenses and regulatory fees, the cash was finally rolling in. They just had nowhere to put it. While most Americans enjoy the security of banking systems, those in the legal marijuana economy remain vulnerable. Despite being completely transparent about their business from the beginning, following his accountant's advice to be open and notorious, Hageseth's first bank kicked them out after 18 months. When a third local Denver bank announced it was offering commercial marijuana checking accounts to state-licensed dealers, they rushed to open an account along with seemingly every other grower and dispensary owner in the city. But predictably, someone at headquarters eventually connected the dots about federal prosecution risk, and they were out on the street again with another rejection letter for Hageseth's growing collection. Despite a 2014 White House announcement supporting changes to federal banking guidelines, they realized it would take an act of Congress to get banks to change, and they remained locked out. Running a million-dollar company in an all-cash position is challenging but possible. They formed a holding company to flow enough cash to write checks for taxes and essential bills. For state taxes, they literally walk cash into the Colorado Department of Revenue office next to the state capitol. Federal taxes must be remitted electronically, requiring ingenuity similar to paying large vendor bills. In the federal government's eyes, they're laundering money with every transaction, though no law enforcement has cracked down on them yet. They use security firms, cameras, and alarms, but there are always days when you need to ferry thousands to vendors yourself. The danger of robbery aside, dealing in cash is simply inefficient for legitimate businesses of their size. "I am not Tony Montana or Walter White," Hageseth writes, "yet every day I commit two federal crimes, growing and selling marijuana, and laundering money by paying employees and taxes. We are not criminals, but the law forces us to behave like them." While marijuana is associated with feelings of euphoria, it can also cause paranoia if you're not careful. But Hageseth noticed a bizarre paranoia surrounding the industry that came from people who weren't smoking marijuana at all. He calls this marijuana legalization denial syndrome, MLDS, the inability to accept marijuana's legality at face value. When Mr. Pink and Hageseth first invested in legal cannabis, their spouses worried the law might be repealed, leading to their immediate arrest. Longtime marijuana smokers feared the law was a ploy to identify and later arrest them. Many couldn't believe the government was actually allowing this to happen. When applying for business licenses and permits, they faced quiet resistance from city and state employees gripped by MLDS. I know it's the law, but I haven't been told how to handle it, and I'm not going out of my way for people like you. For the first time, Hegeseth felt the sting of prejudice. They assumed he was a criminal exploiting a loophole. The law was unambiguous. Marijuana was legal. He could only meet this prejudice with quiet persistence. The bureaucratic resistance was maddening. When requesting business licenses or building permits, he'd be told, "There's no such thing as a business license for medical marijuana," or "There's no building code for a marijuana grow." Of course not. The law was new, but were they really going to refuse to help? Yes, they were. Nothing irritates an entrepreneur more than pencil pushers who can't be bothered to solve problems. They'd acknowledge marijuana was legal, but claimed they hadn't been instructed what to do about it. Hegeseth tried to understand everyone's perspective. Imagine spending your entire career hearing only one message about marijuana, busting thousands of people, and witnessing what violent drug users had done to cities. You'd be suspicious if the law suddenly said marijuana was okay. Our national policy on marijuana was built on distortions and injustice. Since Nixon's era, marijuana arrests skyrocketed from 119,000 Americans annually in 1965 to over 800,000 today. 22 million people arrested since Nixon. Half of all drug arrests are marijuana-related, with sentences disproportionately harder on minorities. Cynically speaking, marijuana prohibition keeps our justice system running. Jails stay full, courts stay busy, law enforcement gets funding, and rehab centers get clients. Busting people for marijuana is efficient. It gets the largest number of people into the justice system for the smallest possible infraction. But Americans became more savvy about marijuana and demanded change. All the legal marijuana movement needed was more people with experience to realize the herb had legitimate medical uses, that responsible use was possible, and that it was safer than alcohol in most hands. In 2014, Green Man Cannabis won the Cannabis Cup for their Ghost Train Haze strain, their second cup victory in 5 years. The team celebrated on stage with breeder Scott Reach, and CBS This Morning interviewed Hegeseth with Charlie Rose introducing him as the man who grew the best marijuana in the country. Though they spent $72,000 on the event, the brand recognition was invaluable for their future cannabis ranch plans. Days after their Cannabis Cup triumph, Hegeseth's master grower Corey dropped a bombshell. He couldn't put his name on their Nevada application because he'd secretly negotiated with competitors who offered him 40% ownership. Hegeseth was furious at his betrayal, especially after advocating for his equity package. But after cooling down, he realized he might have done the same in Corey's position. Rather than fighting, he proposed a win-win solution. Corey could become a consultant, leveraging his expertise with multiple clients, including them, potentially earning millions without relocating his family. When Hegeseth presented this to his angry board, he convinced them to see the bigger picture, that maintaining a positive relationship with Corey served everyone better than burning bridges. In 2013, Hegeseth began creating business plans for potential investors. His background in real estate gave him an advantage over competitors who entered the cannabis industry without business experience. Many dispensary owners were former illegal growers or recession refugees seeking an easier life, not understanding the hustle required. The industry was rapidly changing and consolidating, with licensed retailers declining 40% in Colorado's early years. Hegeseth was constantly meeting potential investors, Colorado locals, out-of-towners, wealthy parents setting up their children in business, and even big tobacco representatives watching the industry closely. Many cannabis business owners didn't understand basic concepts like the difference between loans and equity investment. He aimed to create a company with the brand loyalty of Ben & Jerry's and Starbucks, where customers would be loyal to specific strains like Skunkberry and Ghost Train Haze, just as ice cream lovers are loyal to Cherry Garcia or Chunky Monkey. His meetings with potential investors often required significant education about the cannabis industry. Individual investors wanted both profits and social cachet, while institutional investors focused solely on returns. Colorado's residency requirements eliminated many interested parties, including athletes with morality clauses in their contracts. One NBA player loved marijuana for relaxation, but could only use it during summer to avoid drug tests. The rapper Redman wanted to invest and have a strain named after him. Another potential investor offered $1 million in cash via duffel bag, expecting Hegeseth to launder it, an offer he immediately refused. Even devout Christian investors approached him, concerned about biblical perspectives on cannabis. He addressed religious concerns by citing Genesis 1:29, where God gives humans every plant yielding seed on earth. His two large investors for the cannabis ranch included William from Wichita and a $4 billion New York private equity firm. They would buy land, build facilities, and lease to them, sidestepping residency restrictions. After months of negotiations, he secured commitments for $9 million from these institutional investors. At a political fundraiser for Colorado's governor, hosted by cannabis entrepreneurs, including himself, Hegeseth marveled at how their presence was not only tolerated but welcomed. Politicians now sought their votes, support, and donations. He realized the future Steve Jobs of marijuana was likely in that room. Major industry players were emerging who would surprise the business world. Colorado's approximately 500 dispensaries will likely shrink to fewer than 300 within 5 years, operated by larger, more capable companies. Smart entrepreneurs will buy out smaller competitors rather than starting new locations from scratch. While acquiring existing operations seems expensive, the efficiency and value creation makes it worthwhile. Spending $100 million on dozens of dispensaries could create a rebranded chain worth over $300 million. The cannabis industry is transitioning from a little house on the prairie model to a massive corporate megalopolis. When Hegeseth entered the business in 2009, starting costs ranged from $10,000 to $1 million. Today, just applying for a license in Aurora requires demonstrating access to over $400,000 in liquid assets. Cities and states will welcome marijuana companies, but prefer well-heeled, organized firms that can quickly generate tax revenue. The marijuana industry will evolve like wine, where similar products can command vastly different prices based on quality and branding. Though marijuana is currently treated as a commodity, this will change rapidly. The firms that establish consumer affinity through quality product, strategic locations, distinctive packaging, appropriate pricing, and excellent service will capture the largest market share. Medical marijuana is already legal in 25 states and D.C., but the systems vary widely in effectiveness. Recreational legalization would simplify matters enormously. By 2020, 10 to 15 states could make this transition as they observe the positive economic and social data emerging from Colorado and Washington. The evidence that legalization can be implemented prudently will ultimately persuade reasonable voters and legislators. Today's marijuana is nearly 8 times more potent than what was smoked at Woodstock. Most people take only 1 or 2 hits, not an entire joint. The industry will evolve toward consistently dosed servings, similar to how alcohol is standardized. 1 ounce spirits equals 5 ounce wine equals 12 ounce beer. These dosing guidelines should be proactively created by the industry rather than waiting for government mandates. Major newspapers like the New York Times have already called for marijuana legalization, citing scientific evidence that risks are negligible compared to tobacco and alcohol. Federal lawmakers are watching state legalization efforts and voter sentiment. Eventually, the combination of tax revenue potential, medical demand, and successful state rollouts will force comprehensive action to address federal marijuana laws. Banking and tax issues need immediate resolution, but Congress is likely to ignore the industry until billion-dollar firms and large corporations have significant investments. Congress must allow banks to offer account services to qualified cannabis companies with proper vetting and transparency. The current requirement to remit taxes electronically without having access to bank accounts creates an impossible situation. Big Tobacco, Big Agra, and Big Pharma are watching the cannabis industry closely, each with its own agenda. The current charm of locally produced, minimally processed marijuana will likely change when large corporations enter. Big Agra may patent genetic sequences and develop pest-resistant strains, while Big Pharma will push for control over the plant to generate lab-grown substitutes. Yet the beauty of marijuana is its simplicity, just the plant, humans, and fire. Big Pharma makes drugs. God created marijuana. Whom do you trust? In September 2014, Hage closed on the 15-acre cannabis ranch site, celebrating with Ghost Train Haze, the world's best weed. The project would transform a former airplane junkyard into a beautiful facility, starting with soil remediation that would create space for a 50,000-square-foot basement grow with 600 lights. Adjacent would be a 100,000-square-foot greenhouse, the first such marijuana facility in the world. The cannabis ranch's progress required structuring their operations into two companies, one growing and selling marijuana, the other raising capital and developing the Green Man brand. To avoid potential conflicts of interest, Hage would resign as CEO of the marijuana operation to lead American Cannabis Partners, while remaining chairman of both boards. The cannabis ranch represents Hage's vision for normalizing marijuana in American culture. The ranch's visitor experience is deliberately symbolic. Guests will descend into the basement grow, then walk through glass-walled hallways before rising via elevators into the glass greenhouse. This journey mirrors America's own path to enlightenment about marijuana, moving from the closet into the open, from darkness into light. "Marijuana has been my salvation," Hage reflects. Looking in the mirror, he sees a transformed man, not the same person who nearly destroyed his health running a business into the ground. Despite obstacles, resistance, and betrayal, he's thrived. His daughters are learning their father follows his bliss while creating something meaningful. His mother watches her son achieve his dream while remembering her late partner who benefited from cannabis. Even his physician father, recently diagnosed with Parkinson's, has found improvement using cannabidiol and enthusiastically shared his findings at medical conferences. The legal marijuana industry represents America's evolution toward becoming a better society after a century of punishing citizens for using a relatively harmless plant. What began as a charade has become a process of enlightenment, righting past wrongs, and growing as a society. The cannabis industry has been built through creativity rather than following established business rules, inventing solutions where none existed, and setting standards that will define the future.